Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dale Peterson, and we will be talking about his new book, The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. On July 12, 1969, Ruth Davis, a young American volunteer at Dr. Jane Goodall's famous chimpanzee research camp in the Gombe Stream National Park of Tanzania, East Africa, walked out of camp to follow a chimpanzee into the forest. 6 days later, her body was found floating in a pool at the base of a high waterfall. With careful detail, The Ghosts of Gombe reveals for the first time the full story of the day-to-day life in Goodall's wilderness camp, the people and the animals, the stresses and excitements, the social conflicts and cultural alignments, and the astonishing friendships that developed between three of the researchers and some of the chimpanzees during the months preceding that tragic event. Was Ruth's death an accident? Did she jump? Was she pushed? In an extended act of literary forensics, Goodall biographer Dale Peterson examines how Ruth's death might have happened and explores some of the painful sequelae that haunted two of the survivors for the rest of their lives. For more information about Dale and his work, you can visit his website, which is dalepetersonauthor.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dale to the show. Good day, sir.
Well, thank you, Robert. I'm glad to be here.
It's my pleasure. This is a fascinating book. But before we start talking about that, I usually like to start the show by having the guests kind of give a little bit about their journey and what got them to the point of what they're doing now. So if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about yours and how you got to be the type of writer that you are at the moment.
Well, it's a somewhat complicated story. I think I've been writing about animals and elephants and giraffes and primates and animal people, including Jane Goodall, for the last two decades, maybe longer, maybe three. I've lost count. But I have no background in zoology or biology. I'm a writer. I studied English in college and finished with a PhD a few years back in California and set out to become a writer. I didn't quite know how to do that, and the fact is the only way to do it is to write and then get published. But in the meantime, after getting the degree, I became a carpenter for a couple of years, at that point trying to write children's stories. And eventually I turned to writing about computers. It was the early 80s, and I was in California, Northern California, in the midst of the computer revolution there. And so I knew a lot of people in the computer business, including Steve Jobs. And Steve I knew because I did carpentry on his house. And so I started writing books about computers, and that was my start in as a writer. I originally thought I would write fiction, but I realized that I preferred nonfiction. I'm more comfortable with nonfiction, but I still think it's creative writing, and certainly that's been my goal all these many years, is to write creatively nonfiction. With a few computer books under my belt, then I asked myself, well, what is the subject I care about? And the answer came back, animals. I like animals. I care about animals. And so then the question was, what kind of animal? And the answer came back almost randomly. My wife pulled an article out of a newspaper about primates. So I said, all right, I'm going to write a book about primates. I taught myself. I didn't even know what a primate was, and perhaps people in the audience don't know either. It's actually, primates are a group of, these days, more than 400 different species of monkeys and apes and lemurs and other prosimians, primitive primates. And humans are considered to be a primate. So I wrote that book. First I learned what a primate was, then I wrote the book. And in the process, in realizing that you can't just study primates in a book, if you're going to write about them, you actually have to see them. So I traveled around the world and looking for the world's 12 most endangered primate species. I went through South America, down the Amazon, across Africa, into southern India and Southeast Asia, and completed a book that was published in 1989. That was, I don't know, my fifth book maybe, or sixth book. The previous ones were computer books. And then I met Jane Goodall. And the way that happened was, chimpanzees are a primate species, but I didn't write about them in the first book about primates because, number one, I felt there was so much already written about them, and they're probably the most thoroughly studied primate species of all, largely because of Jane Goodall. So having finished that first book, I finally decided, well, I'm going to enter the fray here and write a great book about chimpanzees, but I needed an expert to help me because I'm not an expert.
Mm-hmm.
So I read an article in a magazine, and I contacted the author of the article. His name was Geza Teleki. And I went down to, he said, fine, I'm interested in helping you if you want to write a book about chimpanzees. So I went down to visit him in his home in Washington. And when I got there, Geza and I talked for a while, and he said, well, you know, how would you like to write a book with Jane Goodall? As it turned out, Geza was a friend of Jane's. He had actually been her student many years ago. And then he was her colleague, having gotten a PhD himself and having studied chimpanzee. So Geza introduced me to Jane. And Jane and I did write a book together. It was called Visions of Caliban, and it was a success. I've done two co-author books, and I can say that co-authoring a book with somebody it's a little bit like getting married. It's a very intimate relationship. There's ego involved, there's money involved, there's a lot of time and energy involved, and you can wind up hating that other person if it doesn't work out. If it does work out, you at least have a lifelong friend, and that's what happened with me and Jane. It worked out. We've been friends ever since that co-authorship. I followed that up with a biography of Jane, which came out in 2006. And that, of course, I spent 10 years working on that. Got to know Jane as well as anybody knows her. I got to know her entire family, everyone who was alive at the time, her father, her mother, her aunt, her nanny, her childhood best friend, that sort of thing. And read all of her, all of her personal letters. And so I got to know Jane very, very, very well by the end of that book. And then there was one thing that I, in the book, there was this story about this woman who died at her research camp in 1969. And the woman who died, her name was Ruth. She was an American. She was a volunteer. And she died July 12th, 1969. She disappeared. And Jane had mentioned Ruth. And I knew about Ruth partly because Ruth was Gay Zatelicki's lover. They were, you know, they were going to get married. He was at Gombe at that time. And so I wrote a chapter on Ruth and Geza and that period. But Geza never talked about Ruth. He was very, didn't seem like he wanted to talk about her. And Jane only mentioned just the briefest things about her. So I did happen to have some, you know, some letters about Ruth. And the chapter is in that biography is based on some of those letters, but then, so the biography came out in 2006. In 2008, Geza, my old friend, the person who had introduced me to Jane so many years earlier, called me up. Dale, I need to talk. And he wanted to talk about Ruth. Geza, by then, was dying. And that's another story in itself, but it was a long, slow, painful death. And he had spent most of his life just trying to forget what happened to Ruth. It was so traumatic. By about 2008, he was trying to remember. And the memory itself was traumatic. And so I became his therapist. I would go down to Washington, D.C., where he lived, and I'd sit, you know, I'd spend a couple of days with him, and he'd talk and talk, and I tape recorded everything because Geza and I both recognized it might be a book. And I did this for a couple of years, really. You know, every 6 months I'd go down and talk to Geza, and we'd have our, what I call our therapy sessions. I don't know if he ever thought of them that way, but they were pretty much. And That's the core of the book that I finally wrote. And along with that core, Geza introduced me to some other people who had been at Gombe at that time. One in particular was a woman named Carol Gale, who was the one who discovered Ruth's body. And she also, like Geza, was very traumatized by this whole event. And Carol, I think, had ambitions of writing her own book about Ruth, but Carol was also dying by the time I met her. And so she also, like Geza, really unburdened herself to me at great length. Those two sets of interviews are the core material, but of course Jane Goodall participated. She gave me opinions. I had lots of letters that Jane had written during the period. I had letters from National Geographic. I interviewed other people. So that's where the book comes from. That's the core material of the book that is now out there called The Ghosts of Gombe.
Wow, boy, that is a story.
Yeah.
The connection, how the connection with Jane worked out, and everybody, and then the idea of wanting to make sure that the story got out before they died. I mean, it seems like quite often people who are at that stage of life, that there's quite often really want to make sure that if something, especially if it's a loved one, with Ruth, that it's, kind of to immortalize her in a way.
Yeah. No, that's what it was. And they've both since passed away. Geza died in 2014 and Carol died, I believe, in 2011. But they both, I felt quite close to them both by the end of our interviews, and I think they both felt better having talked to me.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about Jane Goodall. Obviously, if it took 10 years to get that biography. Was it 10 years for to get the biography done? Was that right?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
That was, yeah. I mean, that's an awful long awful long time.
Well,
for
it
a
is.
Project.
I wrote 4 other books during that same period, so sometimes I work on 2 books at once. But it was still a very long time. It was a huge project. But I had, special access to Jane that nobody else had. And I also had material that nobody else had, like all of Jane's personal letters. Her mom gave me those, and nobody else had those. So it was, it's a big biography, and I felt Jane was a major, major figure in 20th century science. So I took it very seriously.
Yeah. So in the process of doing the biography, what is your sense of the character of Jane, of how she's portrayed as compassionate, but quite honestly, we all have a little bit of shadow in our lives. What about Jane? How did can you insight?
I'll contrast her with Diane Fossey, who was followed Jane by a few years, and Diane, of course, studied gorillas. Jane studied chimps, and Diane was the one who was murdered. And Diane really did have a dark side. She was, she was had temper. She had passions, and some of those parts of her personality have come out in the biographies that have been written about Diane. And I know that there were some times when I kind of wished Jane had some dark sides because I thought it would make the biography more interesting, but she doesn't. She's, the person that you see in films and on television and in public is pretty much the person who's there. She's generous. She's courageous. She's thoughtful. She's, just a very, very impressive person. And, I know that there are secrets and there were things she didn't want me to write about that I actually, I won't say that. She let me write whatever I wanted. But there were things that she was anxious about and a couple of things. And I just wrote them and they're in the book. And she just, kind of shrugged. She was an amazing person to write a biography about. She never, in the entire 10 years, she never once asked me what I was writing. And she never, there was no sense of anxiety about it, no sense of concern. And she, she had filing cabinets full of personal letters, and she would say, okay, Dale, just go through all of these, whatever you want, take. And so there was, she gave carte blanche, no filtering at all. And she didn't even ask whether she could see it when I finished it. And so we never had that discussion, whether she would have the right to, review it. And I probably like most writers, I don't want anybody looking over my shoulder. I resist that idea tremendously. Writing is a very private and personal activity. And so I was delighted that she never asked to see what I was writing, because that was the last thing I wanted. But when the book was finally finished and the manuscript was done and it was about to go into press, I realized it was just common sense and common courtesy to let her see it. So I did send it to her. And she said, oh, thank you. And she looked it over. It was, a very big manuscript. She pointed out, maybe a half dozen or maybe a dozen small errors she thought were errors. And then the biggest complaint I got happened in France, in Paris, after I'd finished this and Jane had seen the manuscript, I went out to Paris to be with Jane because she was receiving the Legion of Honor from the French government, being presented by the Prime Minister of France. And so I went out to go to this spectacular event. And it was, you know, a lot of fun, typical, lots of big stars. Prince of Monaco took Jane out to dinner. And after that evening, after we got back to the hotel, there were a group of Jane's friends, myself, her personal assistant, and a couple of other people sitting in her hotel room late at night drinking scotch. And I was quite tired by then, but Jane doesn't get tired in the way that normal people do. So so she was fully awake, and but I wasn't. Jane was saying something, and I wasn't really listening. But then I eventually realized that what she was talking about had to do with me, and she was saying, you know, she said, there are some people, journalists, who write about me, and they say I have gray hair. I don't have gray hair. What color is my hair, Dale? Well, I'd written she had gray hair, right? So I looked at her, and I said, well, you know, I looked at her across on the other side of the room from me. She was sitting on the bed. I was sitting at a table. And I looked at her, and I thought, first I thought, well, it's gray hair. But then I thought, well, you know, it's kind of, it's silver, Jane. And she said, Dale, what color is my hair? And I couldn't say anything further. So she walked over to where I was sitting, and she undid this, her ponytail. And I'd never seen her hair right out of the ponytail before, because it's always, she always had it in the ponytail. Mm-hmm. She undid the ponytail, and she turned around so that her hair was right in front of my face and right next to the lamp, and she said, Dale, what color is my hair? And I said, well, Jane, you know, there are parts of it are brown, and there's some gold in here, and it's kind of a honey color, and there's an edge of silver. And thank you, Dale, she said, and she put her hair back in a ponytail and sat down. Well, that was the only real comment she had about the manuscript. And if you buy the book,
funny.
you'll see on the second sentence in the book, I talk about the color of her hair in great detail.
Oh, no.
So imagine that, writing a biography about a famous person, and that's the only thing she has to say. That's the only complaint. And, you know, there were things that at first she felt were very private. You know, she had a love mm-hmm. affair, and there were love letters, and I published some of them. And I knew that, you know, when she gave them to me, I could see this was, you know, an area where she was a bit anxious. But it's
right.
extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
It was just... you know, and for me, it's just her character. And, you know, it's with getting back to the Ghosts of Gombe, this latest book, Jane is in this book. So it is, I think of it as a continuation of the biography in many ways. It's a part of the biography that I didn't tell in great detail, and now I do. And there, you know, there's a part in there where her husband at the time does not come off well. And I was a little concerned that Jane may object to this. And she didn't say a word about it. She just said, you know, oh, I think that's probably true, Dale. This is, you know, among her many qualities is this kind of lack of ego, the normal ego that the rest of mm-hmm. us have. I mean, she does have an ego, of course. And I know she can mm-hmm. be insulted, and I know all of, you know, but she doesn't, the small things don't bother her. She's really focused mm-hmm. on the big things in the world, and she's just this extraordinary character.
Wow. I mean, that's truly amazing when you know, you think about someone who is, you know, so accomplished and, you know, in the public eye, and, you know, there's it's obvious that she is, you know, well-grounded, you know, so to speak, you know, and comfortable in who she is, and otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have had such free access to so many parts of her life. I mean, and it obviously goes to show how much she trusted you, too.
Right, yeah. All of that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're a little past halfway through the show, Dale, so I want to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask Dale any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in there. And then when we come back from the break, Dale, I want to talk a little bit about the friendships that you talk about in The Ghosts of Gombe between the, you know, the researchers and the animals, and kind of get a sense of what that's all about, okay?
All right, sure.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest is Dale Peterson, author of The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is dalepetersonauthor.com. And do pick up this book. It is a very good read. So with that, we're back, Dale.
Yes.
Okay, so in the book, you talk about, you know, the friendships between the researchers, and obviously you mentioned Giza and Ruth's love relationship, but also relationships, friends with the animals. So can you talk a little bit about that environment and, you know, how, you know, that friendship, you know, between man and beast kind of took
right.
place.
No, it's, you know, the book is, the core, the spine of the story, of course, has to do with Ruth's death and with trying to figure out how she died, what caused her death. And the way I do that is I simply present all of the information I can about the people and the situation, and at the research site over the year and a half before Ruth died. And one of the striking things that happened was that some of the researchers eventually just became friends with some of the chimpanzees. Now, this is science. They're doing science. They're scientists. They're supposed to be studying wild animals. So the idea that you would become friends with your research subjects is strange. And I think I understand it. You know, chimpanzees are extraordinary animals. They're our closest living relatives. And what that means, that's in an evolutionary sense, and what that means is that they share more than 99% of their DNA with us. That means, more specifically, that, for example, any infectious disease that a person can get, a chimpanzee can get, and vice versa. And you can have a blood transfusion from a chimpanzee. They're that close to us. And they're close to us not only in appearance, but also in psychology. Their minds are quite a bit like us, and their emotional systems are like us. Now, when I think about friendships with animals, well, you know, I've had dogs, many dogs, and in some ways I feel those dogs are my friends. But so it's not completely crazy that you would be a friend with an animal, but these are wild animals, and this is also scientific research, and the concept of it is you're studying the animals, you're being an objective observer. So how did that line get crossed is the question, and the answer, I talk about it in the book, but it's there was an interesting change in the research protocol that happened in 1968 and 69. And that change, you know, Jane, when she originally came to Gambia in 1960, just nobody knew how to study chimps. So she set up a tent and she just watched the chimpanzees, and eventually they got used to her. Other people said, you know, other people said chimpanzees are wild and they're dangerous. They're very powerful animals, very quick. And there was a lot of people were convinced that anybody who tried to study chimps in the wild would be torn to pieces by these animals. Jane just didn't think so. So she went out there and she just began to watch them. But she didn't act, she didn't try to sneak up on them. So she just showed herself. And, right. You know, when they first saw her, they'd run. They were, you know, it's a person, it's dangerous. But eventually they stopped running. And eventually, over months and months and months, some of the chimpanzees became essentially bored with her. And so she could start to study them. But it was still a very difficult thing. And the other thing about Gambia is that the terrain itself is really, really difficult. So, you know, there are ravines, there are high cliffs. It's probably the worst, most difficult terrain of any chimpanzee research site in the world. And right now there are, you know, about a half dozen. And, you know, I've been to four of them, and you know there's one in Uganda, for example. The land, the terrain is pretty much flat, so it's an easier thing to find the chimpanzees. At Gambia, you can find them, but then how do you follow them? So Jane, Jane was able to get some scientific information. She did a lot of observation. She was a tough person. She did a lot of following. But by the late 1960s, Jane was trying to set up a scientific research station where she wouldn't be the only person doing the research. She wanted to bring in other scientists and develop the research, professionalize it, basically, and she was bringing in young scientists and young students and volunteers, and she really thought that the best way to study the chimps at that time was just to put out bananas in camp, and the bananas, you know, the chimps, just for them, it was very exciting because here was food, and so they'd come into camp to get the bananas, and it worked out pretty well. The researchers, you know, just they'd put out the bananas the night before, the chimps would come in, and the researchers would sit down and study the chimps. And by then, the chimps were used to people, so they didn't react to, they just ignored the people, and, You know, they sat around, they ate the bananas, and then they socialized and interacted with each other in a way that was pretty normal. And so it was good science. They were studying chimpanzee behavior. They were studying chimpanzee sociality. They were studying chimpanzee society. What's the nature of chimpanzee society? They were beginning to get a sense of who was in charge and what were the relationships between the individuals. And so all of this was going well, but the fly in the ointment figuratively turned out to be baboons. In the spring of 1968, the baboons were discovering that there were bananas in the forest. So the baboons were showing up at camp, and that made everything complicated. You'd have chimps show up sometimes and sometimes not, and there might be, you know, any day there might be five chimps show up, or there might be a dozen, or there might even be a couple of dozen. But the baboons, unlike chimps, always travel in a troop, which is, they're always with each other 24 hours a day. So chimps are not like that. They don't live in troops. Baboons do. So when the baboons showed up, it wouldn't be one or two, it'd be 50. And
wow.
And baboons are a kind of monkey. They're smaller than chimpanzees, but the baboon males are not that much smaller. And they have, they're pretty ferocious, ferocious looking too. The males have, I'd say they weigh maybe 65 pounds. They're twice the size of the adult females. And they have huge, enormous canine teeth, just basically fangs. And they can be very aggressive. So there were conflicts between the chimpanzees and the baboons. And those conflicts were exacerbated by the fact that chimpanzees are meat eaters, and they sometimes eat baby monkeys. Well, baboons are a kind of monkey, and they would sometimes grab a baby baboon. And when that happened, it was total chaos because all of the baboons would try to defend their baby from a chimp. So they were getting a situation that was untenable. And Jane was not there that spring, so the people running the camp, the scientists and their volunteers, were in touch with her by radio telephone, and they said, you know, this is not working. So Jane decided, and she actually showed up in June to discuss this in great detail. She was there for the summer of 68. She decided that they would reduce the banana feeding significantly. So instead of putting out bananas every day and having the chimps come in, they would put out bananas once every 5 days or 6 days or 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that pretty much worked. It discouraged the baboons. The chimps would still occasionally show up to check and see if there were any bananas, and then when they didn't see any, they would go away. So they were still getting the chimps coming in. They were still getting the scientific work done, studying the chimp relationships and their social behavior and so on. But they weren't getting as much. And so the researchers said, well, you know, now that they're not coming into camp all the time, maybe we should go follow them into the forest. And so they did. They began following the chimps into the forest. Well, as I said about Gombe before, it's an extremely rugged terrain. You can't really follow a chimpanzee unless the chimpanzee allows you. So, you know, because they, you know, a chimp can climb a tree in 5 seconds from the bottom to the top. You know, a chimp can cross a ravine by swinging on a vine or leaping from one tree to another. They're terrific acrobats. They're very strong. So any chimp who didn't want to be followed could just disappear, and they would do that in a second. So it turned out that the chimps were selecting people to follow them. They would wait because they had preferences about people. And so the chimps had preferences, and then the people developed preferences about the chimps. So what you had then was particular researchers following particular chimpanzees into the forest. So Geza was one of the researchers, Geza Teleki, and his favorite chimpanzee was a chimpanzee named Leaky, and Leaky just liked Geza. Leaky was an old grouch. He didn't like females. He would throw stones at females. But Geza, he would let him follow. And Rubens had developed a favorite, a big male named Hugh, who was so big and so aggressive that all of the other researchers were afraid of him. Well, Hugh would let Ruth follow. And so they developed these real friendships, and they were to the point, you know, Geza tells it, this wonderful story, I have it in the book, where he went out with Leaky into the forest and following him during the day. And, you know, chimpanzees in the middle of the day at the hottest point, it's pretty normal for them to take a nap. It's, you know, it's they spend their day looking for food. And but in the middle of the day, the hottest point of the day, they usually take a siesta. And they may be one chimpanzee, or it may be a group of five or even 10 chimps traveling together. So this day, Geza was following Leaky, the chimpanzee, and about noontime, it became apparent to Geza that Leaky was getting ready to take a nap. He was settling down, and they were in a meadow, and Leaky was kind of looking for a place that was comfortable to relax. It seemed to Geza this was happening, and so Geza sat down, and you know, he had a paperback in his back pocket. He knew this was going to be a period that the chimpanzee would nap, and he had to at least stay alert. So he brought out his paperback and sat down and began to relax himself. Well, before he knew it, Leaky had moved up right next to him, and then began just trying to make himself comfortable. Eventually, he put his head on Geza's foot. And Geza's foot, you know, Geza was wearing sneakers on his feet, so Leaky put his head on Geza's foot, trying to relax, and then still trying to settle down, he picked up the foot and he dragged it and put it in another position, put his head back down, and he was using his foot as a pillow, and then he just went to sleep and started snoring. So, you know, imagine a wild animal in a forest who lies down, puts his head on your foot, and then goes to sleep and starts snoring. That was a level of trust that was just this kind of unbelievable. So that's what I mean by friendships, these trans-species friendships between chimps and humans. And I just find it fascinating, and it was part of, you know, the excitement of writing this book, even though the book is about Ruth and her death. It's also about Gombe and what was going on during that period, a couple of years.
Yeah, that's just amazing. That's what makes the story so much more intriguing. You know, and especially if you don't know much about the topic. And you know, speaking of ghosts and the story about being Ruth, one of the things that I thought was really interesting in the book is when you talked about that Carol, who discovered Ruth's body, was ill when she went missing, but basically Ruth came to her in a vision and kind of led her to the body where nobody else could. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. No, there are ghosts in the story, and of course I don't believe in fictional ghosts, but at least two people had real visions of Ruth, and Carol was one. And it happened when Ruth disappeared on July 12th, 1969. Everybody in camp went out to look for her, and they went out at night with flashlights, and then the next day they went out, but Carol couldn't. Carol was in camp, but she had malaria. She was in bed, and she basically couldn't move. And she stayed in bed. I mean, the search went on for 6 days. Carol stayed in bed, and then on the third day of the search, in the evening, And this is what Carol told me, that Ruth came to her. And Carol doesn't insist this was not a dream. It was it was a vision. And it was Carol came to her, and it was Ruth felt it was real. Ruth came to her, and
yeah.
Carol felt it was real.
Right.
And so Ruth came into the hut where she was sick in bed with malaria, and she opened the door and slammed it shut. And she stood in front of Carol, and she said, "Why haven't you come to find me?" And Ruth's face was covered with blood. And Carol just sat up, just totally, completely terrified by this thing. And she, Carol has always insisted, no, it wasn't a dream. It felt real to her. So that's one of the visions that I talk about. Geza had a similar thing happen in 2008. And that's part of what I mean by the ghosts of Gombe in the title.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dale, it's a really good book. I've really enjoyed reading it. And it's just one of those that, you know, by the time that you're done with it, you just feel like you know the world so much better, you know, in a way. And it was one of the better ones that I've read in a long, 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 long time. So I really want to thank you for spending the time to talk to me about it today. It's really been a great discussion.
Well, great talking to you too, Robert. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dale Peterson, and we've been talking about his book, The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website, dalepetersonauthor.com. His book is available at amazon.com, so definitely go there and get a copy. It'll be a great summer reading for you. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.